a defining moment, brokerage, trade, or business. This is the Tax Update Podcast for March 9, 2009. The Tax Update Podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research, confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and the document may be reproduced freely as long as no fee is charged for the use of this document. Such prohibited use includes using this podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. In one sense, this week's case has to be approached cautiously, as it came down to us in a tax court summary case opinion, a case that makes clear on the very cover page that's published each time the tax court published one of these, that the case cannot be treated as precedent for any other case. But we can consider the legal analysis inherent in the opinion and the fact that the IRS did end up failing to convince the tax court of a position which reports on the California Society of CPAs Tax Talk Discussion Group indicate have been asserted quite often in exams in that state. And that happens to be the state where this particular case came down from. This week's case involves Sudha Agarwal, a real estate agent who worked full-time at a Century 21 brokerage in California. Ms. Agarwal was licensed as a real estate agent by the state of California and not as a real estate broker. In the case of Agarwal v. Commissioner, TC Summary 2009-29, the IRS argued that she did not meet the definition of performing her services in a real property trade or business as defined by Section 469C7 Cap C, and so she could not make the election under Section 469C7 Cap A to ignore Section 469C2 and test her rental real estate activities under the standard test we use for passive activities in other areas. The effect of this, when coupled with the proper grouping elections, is to often allow individuals who can qualify for this provision to be able to deduct losses from rental activities and not having the losses blocked as being passive under the automatic passive treatment of 469C2. We should all be generally aware of the general passive activity loss rules found in Section 469 that serve to limit the taxpayer's ability to deduct passive losses. These rules were enacted in 1986 in the 1986 Tax Reform Act to serve what turned out to be a very effective block on what was prior to that date the widespread sale of investment activities created primarily to spin off losses to be deducted against other income of the investors. These, generally partnerships, were the most popular tax shelters of the day. While as a general rule, trade or business activities were tested against the amount of direct involvement the taxpayer has with the activities, rental real estate properties were subjected to special rules. Some of these rules were positive, like the special $25,000 loss allowance for taxpayers whose income is below certain levels. But the more general problem that was very upsetting to real estate professionals was the provision found in 469C2 that defined the term passive activity to include any rental activity. The original version of that section that was passed in the Tax Reform Act of 1986 did not contain what exists today in the first clause of that provision that provides an exception to this test by referring you to paragraph 7 of section 469C. At the original time of the 86 Act, all rental real estate was simply defined as a passive activity, period. In 1993, the Congress, in response to continuing complaints from those who had real estate-related businesses about the basic unfairness of such a broad-brush treatment against what was truly their day-to-day business, added Section 469C7 to the Code. At Section 469C7A, Congress created an exception for tax for certain qualified taxpayers to the broad-brush treatment of real estate as passive that's generally found at 469C2. It provided special rules for taxpayers in a real property business. And it said that if this paragraph applied to a taxpayer, that the disallowance found at Section 469C2 would not apply for that taxable year, and that this section must be applied as if each interest of the taxpayer in rental real estate were a separate activity. Now, despite that second clause that said we have to treat each rental standing alone, which makes qualifying for non-passive activity treatment more difficult, since we have to meet the hours requirements found in the regulation, the provision goes on to note that a taxpayer may elect to treat all interest in rental real estate as one activity. It also reminds us that despite this rule, if those activities are held in limited partnerships, the overriding rule for limited partnerships, which were another type of entity, another type of activity that automatically became passive, still apply to those activities. The key issue here is that in any particular case, we can elect to treat all interest as a rental, as one interest, and that the provision generally is elective here. If the election is made, the default is that each rental is treated as a separate activity by the real estate professional. That creates its own problem, as noted, due to hours, so quite often we see the second election made, which allows us to group these activities together. To be a qualified taxpayer, the individual looks to the definition of an eligible taxpayer that's found in Section 469C7B. And that notes that this paragraph shall apply to a taxpayer if, and there's a two-prong test, more than one half of the personal services performed in trade or businesses by that taxpayer must be performed in real property trade or businesses in which the taxpayer materially participates, and the taxpayer has to perform more than 750 hours during the year in real property trades or business in which they actively participate. It notes that in the case of a joint return, the requirements of the sentence are satisfied only if either spouse separately satisfies such requirements. And basically, for purposes of that sentence, activities in which a spouse materially participates shall be determined under subsection 8 of section 469. So a taxpayer has to show that more than one half of the personal services he or she performed during the year in a real property trade or business in which they materially participate. So someone doing real estate work on the side who has a full-time job outside of the real estate business basically need not apply. And they must show that that work amounts to at least 750 hours in order to meet this requirement. As well, we have a couple of special rules of Section 469C7D. It tells us that, in essence, it has a special rule for closely held C corporations. We won't get into that too much, except to remind you that they are subject to the Section 469 rules generally. But then notices that personal services as an employee generally will not count for this purpose unless a taxpayer is a greater than 5% owner. Now, that's an interesting quirk, because this is probably one of the few places I can think of in the code where becoming a greater than 5% owner, as defined in Section 416I1B, is referenced, and qualifying under that becomes a benefit to the taxpayer. But the key question for today is determining just what is a real property trade or business that would qualify for this treatment. That leads us to the provision that gets put under the microscope today, Section 469C7C. That says, for purposes of this paragraph, the term real property trade or business means any real property development, redevelopment, construction, reconstruction, acquisition, conversion, rental, operation, management, leasing, or brokerage trade or business. The last item in that list is the one that today's case deals with, that of participating in a brokerage trade or business. The IRS has been reported to have been asserting quite often in examinations that since states license real estate brokers separate from real estate agents, to be performing services in a brokerage trade or business, one must be a licensed broker as opposed to being a licensed real estate agent or salesperson. As we'll discover, at least in today's case, the tax court did not accept that assertion. Let's take a look at the case itself. As we noted initially, this is a tax court summary opinion and as such does not directly have precedential value. But it certainly is a case of interest, especially in a market that's now become more challenging, shall we say, in real estate, and for which we now have a 5-year net operating loss carryback provision in place for losses in 2008. So the matter could carry some very real interest for many clients who are real estate agents that would like to take advantage of the provision to be able to make use of the significant rental losses they have. As real estate agents, service businesses with you normally not hugely significant expenses to be incurred, they may not have a loss in the real estate agent business by itself, but they may very well have a much more significant loss if we look at their rental properties, which may also have been suffering during the current economic downturn and the downturn in the rental in the real estate market. Let's look at the tax court opinion to outline the nature of Ms. Agarwal's business activities during the years in question, 2001 and 2002. The court notes that during those years, she worked full-time as a real estate agent at Century 21 Albert Fouled Realty, which is a brokerage firm. That was a licensed brokerage in the state of California. During those 2 years, she was licensed as a real estate agent. She was not licensed as a broker. She actually finally got licensed as a broker in 2007. She worked for the brokerage firm pursuant to an independent contractor agreement between broker and associate licensee. That contract provided that she was an independent contractor, not an employee of the brokerage firm. And consistent with that status, the brokerage firm issued her a Form 1099 for each year, did not pay her a salary, rather she received the commissions. The contract she had with Century 21 required her to sell, exchange, lease, or rent properties and solicit additional listings, clients, and customers diligently and with her best effort. Given that she would be expected to have expertise in real estate and be around such property regularly, it's not surprising to find that she and her husband own rental properties, two of them, in fact, during the year in question. Nor should it be surprising that rental properties, as is often the case, produce tax losses for the years in question. The court noted that they reported for 2001 total rents of $36,367 on Schedule E, and they reported expenses of $76,471.78 for a $40,104.78 loss on 2001, and in 2002 they had total rents of $45,521, expenses of $65,177, for a $19,656 loss. They claimed the losses in their entirety on the return. The IRS on examination did not allow those losses. It noted it disallowed because it said passive losses are only allowed to the extent they qualify for the special allowance for the rental real estate in the phase-in rules, and that their losses were in excess of the passive income, the special allowance, and the phase-in rules. And since they did not qualify to take it out of the passive activity rules per the IRS's view, because they didn't qualify for the treatment under Section 467C7, the taxpayers were stuck with having passive loss carryovers of these amounts. The real question becomes, what is a brokerage for Section 469C7C? The question becomes, was what she did participating in, or basically her services, were they performed in a real property trade or business? She says, yes, they were. The IRS argued no. The court summarized that the taxpayers are arguing real estate agents should be considered real estate professionals because real estate agents are engaged in a real property brokerage business, in that real estate agents bring together buyers and sellers. The IRS argued that she was a licensed real estate agent and not a licensed real estate broker. Thus, under California law, she could not be engaged in a brokerage trade or business, and therefore she was not engaged in a real property trade or business as defined by Section 469C7C. The tax court had to decide whether, in fact, the term we find in the IRC refers to somebody possessing a state brokerage license, or whether that term had a broader level of coverage. The tax court points out that words in a statute are ordinarily presumed to have the meaning commonly attributed to them. Given that, the court goes on to observe, a term's common or approved usage may be established by a dictionary. Then it goes on to cite Webster's Third New International Dictionary, the 2002 edition, to define brokerage as the business of a broker or the fee or commission for transacting business as a broker. The opinion goes on to outline five activities that it considered to be indicative of the business of a real estate broker. That included, for purposes of Section 469, selling, exchanging, purchasing, renting, or leasing real property, offering to do those activities, negotiating the terms of a real estate contract, listing of real property for sale, lease, or exchange, and procuring prospective sellers, purchasers, lessors, or lessees. The court then turns to the California licensing provision found in California Business and Professional Code to look at what the IRS believes is controlling. The court notes The California law defines the term real estate broker as a person who does or negotiates to do any of the enumerated activities for compensation. That's California Business and Professional Code Section 10131. Similarly, it also defines the term real estate salesman as a person who is employed by a broker and who does any one of that same set of enumerated activities. That's California Business and Professional Code Section 10132. To give the IRS its due, the argument would be that clearly the state of California sees a difference between a real estate broker and a real estate salesman, a distinction that many and perhaps all states make. And since Ms. Agarwal was an independent contractor, her real business was that of a real estate salesperson, not that of a real estate broker. And since a real estate salesperson's activities weren't listed in Section 469C7C, she can't qualify for the benefit of Section 469C7. But the court did not accept that attempt to push the state law definition into this equation. Rather, it stated, whether she is treated as a broker or a salesperson for state law purposes is irrelevant for federal income tax purposes. The test is whether she was engaged in a brokerage within the meaning of Section 469 as defined. Consistent with her real estate salesman's license and pursuant to her contract with the brokerage firm. She was engaged in brokerage, that is, she sold, exchanged, leased, or rented real property and solicited listings. Therefore, she was engaged in a brokerage trade or business within the meaning of Section 469C7C. The result that followed from this finding, as the court went on to point out immediately, is because she owned an interest in rental property, performed more than one half of personal services in real property trades or businesses in which she materially participated, and performed more than 750 hours of services in real property trade or business in which she materially participated, she is a qualifying taxpayer. And for that reason, she would be allowed to deduct the losses originally reported on the 2001 and 2002 Schedule E. Now, as we suggested, this is an interesting case, but one which is a tax court summary case, and so may have some issues if you raise that in an examination with an agent pointing out that front page cover that says, oh, you can't cite this. But it is interesting to note that in a 2007 reported tax court case involving another area of the law, it was the IRS that had prevailed when a taxpayer tried to hide behind a state law definition used for licensing to avoid a consequence the taxpayer did not like. In the case of Rainbow Tax Service versus Commissioner, 128 TC No. 5, the IRS argued that a taxpayer could not look to state law to determine what was accounting for purposes of a taxpayer being subject to the flat 35% tax applicable to personal service corporations. In that case, the taxpayer was pointing again to state law just as the IRS did in the case we looked at today. The court noted there that the taxpayer was arguing under Nevada law, accounting services can be performed only by CPAs, and that because a petitioner is not a CPA firm, does not employ CPAs, and does not perform services which are restricted under Nevada laws to CPAs, petitioner should not be treated as performing accounting services. In essence, petitioner would only treat those services which require a CPA license as accounting services, and would treat other tax preparation and bookkeeping services as non-accounting services. The entity in this question performed those tax return preparation and bookkeeping services, did not perform audits of financial statements. That position is interestingly close to the one the IRS was attempting to push in the Agarwal case, stating that, you know, the state law defined what a broker was. In this case, they're saying the state law defines what an accountant is. Technically, the Rainbow Tax Service Court pointed out the difference between public accounting and accounting, but really that difference was looking at what Nevada was trying to define, which was restricting one type of work, and the feds, which was defining a broader type of work. Like today's case, the court again looks to dictionary definitions for the activities, first for tax services and whether they fit the definition of accounting. The court noted, quoting from Black's Law Dictionary, that accounting has been defined as the process of recording transactions in the financial records of a business and periodically extracting, sorting, and summarizing the recorded transactions to produce a set of financial records. The court noted that tax return preparation, which requires extracting information relating to financial transactions, analyzing that information, and summarizing and reporting that information on a tax return, fits within the above general definition of accounting. The court then looked next at bookkeeping, the other service that Rainbow Tax Service claimed to perform that it didn't see as accounting, since it was not restricted to CPAs under Nevada law that defined accounting that was restricted to CPAs. The court noted that bookkeeping, which Section 448 and the regulations thereunder do not address, has been defined elsewhere as a branch of accounting that deals with the systematic classification, recording, and summarizing of business and financial transactions in the book of account, and that came from Webster's Third New International Dictionary. The court notes that not only does bookkeeping constitute a branch of accounting, but our system of double-entry bookkeeping undergirds modern financial accounting. In a footnote entry explaining that last statement, the court goes on to give us a bit of a history lesson in accounting, and its link to bookkeeping, noted that Luca Pacioli is deemed to be the father of accounting for first documenting the double-entry process of bookkeeping. Thus, bookkeeping is an integral part of accounting, and part of the services they perform being bookkeeping put them into the classification of performing accounting services. Conclusions on this. While the initial case on the real estate professional underlying this discussion is a summary case that's not to be cited as precedent, the court gives a rather concise and, at least to this particular person, a compelling argument that Section 469C7C should not be read so narrowly as to defer to state law licensing definitions strictly, rather applying a common usage standard to determine if a real estate salesperson performs their services in a brokerage business, and it answered that in the affirmative. The Rainbow Tax Services case is very precedential. It's a published tax court opinion that, at the IRS's own behest, had previously used a very similar approach to define a term referenced in the code that also had state law licensing issues. And it came to the same conclusion that we looked to the common meeting and taxpayers meeting that definition rather than simply accepting uncritically the state law licensing definition. Certainly, the logic of Rainbow Tax Services would seem to suggest the result that a real estate salesperson might, despite not being themselves a state-licensed real estate broker, nevertheless be performing such services as far as federal law and the definitions there will be concerned. Viewed that way, the Agarwal opinion serves as an example of the application of Rainbow Tax Services rationale to the definition found at Section 469C7C. Now, this has been the federal tax update, we should say, for this week. Basically, we're looking at, as normal, I'm still on Twitter. I do that sort of background, so if you want to follow me there, Ed Zollers on Twitter. If you've not used Twitter, it's tough to explain. It's easier to go along with and do, but I will post updates as things happen there. Also, as always, this podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, found on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Be sure to visit them there and consider subscribing to their emails newsletters. This has been the Tax Update.